We're doing Binyanabait, and we're having a special class on a quick summary on the laws of marriage. And this is just so that when you get to your own marriage, you'll know what's going on at the wedding. So, in truth, we should begin before marriage, but we're limited in time, so we're going to try to fly through it. And obviously, being that this is a 25-minute class, we can't cover everything. And we're not covering things in depth. We're just trying to get a general picture of what happens at a wedding. But we'll begin with before that. You've dated a girl, and it looks like you're about to get engaged. So call up someone who knows what's expected when you get engaged, so you don't mess up. In different crowds, there are different things expected, but you don't want to mess up. For example, in many crowds it's accepted that you buy the girl a ring after you two decide you're going to get married. Now, that ring is, in many circles, it's accepted that the chatan pays for it. In other circles, it's accepted that the chatan's mother pays for it. Either way, in most circles, it's accepted that that's really the expensive ring that the girl gets, with a diamond or whatever. It depends on what circles you're in and what your expectations are. But before a person gets engaged, he should know what's going to be expected of him. For example, in some circles, it's accepted that the first Shabbat after they get engaged, the chatan is at the kala's house. In some circles, it's accepted that the chatan sends her a huge bouquet after they just got engaged that first Shabbat. So there are all kinds of things which she might be expecting, and you don't want to ruin. It might be accepted in those circles that at the period where they get engaged, at that point where they decide we are going to get married, he gives her a gift. So you want to have a gift ready, be it a siddur, be it a tehillim, or something else. Obviously, when we say a siddur, we don't mean those cheap ones you get free at a wedding. We'll go buy a nice leather-bound one and have her name printed in silver letters, whoa, gold letters, without her last name, because that's about to change. Right? Her Hebrew name, make sure you know which name she likes. But there are practical things which you should know before you get engaged. So someone's going to have to know you're about to get engaged, and preferably someone who knows what's going on, who has a little bit of experience. That's just a word to the wise. So too, during the period of the engagement, there are things that are accepted.
You're talking about the ring there? So why do we actually put rings on?
We'll get to that, okay?
When it's like we're all going, we're going to just put rings on.
It's a good question. We'll get to that, but not even tonight. That, we'll have to wait. Yeah. We got too much other stuff to cover. It's a good question, but let's wait with that. It's accepted that the chatan sends the kala a huge bouquet the last Shabbos before the marriage. There are all kinds of things that are accepted. So you have to find these things out, speak to someone who knows what's going on. You don't want to hurt people's feelings just out of ignorance. So speak to someone, find out what's accepted. And now we're going to get to the chasana, and we're skipping all things that are accepted because I don't think there's a point in going into them because it depends on which crowd you're in. So speak to someone in whichever crowd. What? Chinah, for example, right? Moroccans have a custom of chinah. You have to know what's accepted there. We have parents who call us all the time and ask us, what am I supposed to do for the chinah? And when we tell them what they're supposed to do, they're very upset because they've never heard of this. Moroccans spend more money on the chinah than the wedding. Now, when you tell a parent that they have to fund this and that the gifts they're supposed to give are X, Y, and Z, they're sometimes not so happy to hear it. But you should at least know what's expected of you and then decide what you're going to do and what not. Right, there are many examples of things that are accepted, and I don't think I know all of them. I think that whichever crowd you're in, you should find out what a dao and what crowd, what the customs are. Yeah. Okay. Now we'll get to the wedding itself. Before you come to the wedding, you have to have a ring because it is customary to marry a girl with a ring. Now, there's an engagement ring which has no halachic purpose. It's just it's customary. When you get engaged, you don't have to do anything halachically because halachically nothing happened. Basically, when you get engaged, you two decide that we are going to get married. Until the marriage ceremony, until you cover her with the veil, halachically nothing happened. Halachically, everything else we do is agreement. We say we plan on getting married, we plan on doing such and such. Sometimes we put together a tana'im where when they celebrate the engagement, so they do sign some kind of contract, what each one's going to give the other one, and how much each one's going to bring into the marriage. But halakhically, nothing really happens before the marriage. They are not obligated to one another technically. Realistically, they are obligated because each one is spending a lot of money based on the understanding that they're going to get married. And if one side wants to pull out, then the other side might be able to sue them for all the money that they invested in this and all the shame that was incurred. But halachically, when it comes to what obligates me to marry her, it's the understanding that we have. But there's nothing really binding us. The ring that we give before the marriage is nothing. Practically, once you agree you're getting married, she tells her friends, you tell her friends. If you break that, then you are embarrassing her and you might owe her money for that. And it might be a serious problem to do that. It's not a nice thing to do. So a person shouldn't do that. A person should think well before he gets engaged, and after he gets engaged, he should get married. If he thinks it's the wrong girl after he got engaged, so he should consult with someone to make sure it's not just nerves. And more than likely it is. And if they still reach the conclusion that they should break the engagement, then they should consult with their rabbi how they should do it so the least possible damage is incurred. And he might owe her money. If they invested money in a gown or other things, if he's breaking the engagement, he might owe her that money that he should speak with his rabbi. But that's not our topic tonight. Let's continue. So you're going to have a ring at the marriage. And that ring has to be purchased with your own money. So make sure to have your own money and purchase that ring so that it's yours, not with a credit card, not with a check, with money, because that ring has to be yours. If you're buying it with a credit card, so then ask your rabbi if that's okay, because you might not get billed till later, so each person should speak to his own rabbi. If you want to avoid questions, come with cash. You should know that a lot of the dealers deal with dollars, not with shekalim. They weigh the silver and gold in dollars. You should also know that there are different customs as to what kind of ring you get married with, whether it's a silver ring, a gold ring, white gold, yellow gold. You might want to find out what your family's custom is or what she's expecting. You should also know that I know a dealer and you could get much better rates if you come to me. I'll give you the phone number. And so far, all the guys I've sent him have gotten good rates. I don't yet get a cut on it. I probably should because you guys are still getting a cheaper rate, but so far I haven't done that.
It has to be your money. The money can be given to you as a gift, though?
Correct. And as long as it's yours.
One thing Rav Sperling advised all of his students is buy the rings from a pawn shop. Because he says it's the cheapest way to
do it. I wouldn't do that. There's a lot of thievery going on in jewelry. When I was getting engaged with my wife, I walked into the shop. I wanted to buy a necklace. So I told the guy, I want something up to 100 shekel. So the guy showed me everything he had, and there was one thing I liked. So I said, okay. I said, only show me things up to 100 shekel. So he showed me a necklace, and I told him, okay. So he says, that's 250 shekel. So I said, I told you, show me only things up to 100 shekel. He said, okay, I'll give it to you for 225. I said, okay, I don't have 225 to spend. I'm a yeshiva guy. I don't have any money. So show me other things. Show me everything else. I don't see anything. So he said, I'll give it to you for 200. I said, no, I don't have 200 to spend. I can't buy that. At the end of the day, he saw I was serious. I wasn't playing games. I wasn't coming to bargain. I really couldn't spend more than 100. So I bought it for, like, I think, 115 shekel. Went from 250 to 115. And he was still making a profit. He wasn't doing me any favors. Mm-hmm. And he agreed that I could exchange it if my wife didn't like it. So you should know that that just gives you perspective. The guy was willing to do me a favor and give me for 225 and think that at 115 he was still making a profit. And he was willing to exchange it. So I told him, if she doesn't like it, can I come back? He said, within a week you could exchange it. So that just shows you what's going on in these shops. It's a given. I don't know. She said she did. You never know. The way it works in jewelry is that every hand, every person that goes through is supposed to make at least 100% profit. Just to give you perspective how much they're supposed to be making. And that doesn't mean you're going to be able to get a good rate, but it's advisable to go to a place where you could trust. There's a lot. You can't check if it's 100% gold or not. Okay, so at any rate, you buy a ring. There are customs today, a pi kabbalah. Some get a circle and a square or something. Find out what your kala wants, and she has to be there when you buy the ring because there are measurements for the fingers. And take into account that the fingers expand in the summer when it's hot and contract in the winter. When a woman's pregnant, they also expand, so you want it to fit nicely but not tightly. And the girls should know that. Yeah?
What
luckily the inside of the ring like has to be completely smooth.
Oh, so the base halacha is that the wedding ring is supposed to be a simple ring, because we don't want a situation where the girl says, I thought because of the engravings it was worth such and such. So the custom always was that we get a very simple ring to get married. And that's why a wedding ring is very often a very, very cheap ring, because it has no engravings. It's simple and round. I happen to think that if you get a thin one, it's not only cheaper, but it's also nicer. You get a thick, plain ring, it doesn't look so nice. You get a thin, plain ring, then it looks nice. That's my opinion, but that's taste. You'll see what she likes. But today, a lot of Rabbanim say that you could get ones with engravings, and that's okay. Before a woman gets married, the rabbi shows the Edom and he says, is this worth a pruta? Is this worth like 25 agurot? And each of the Edom say, yeah, it's worth a pruta. Why do we do that? That's so that the girl hears this and she doesn't think, oh, that's worth $500, $2,000, $50 million. She can't say anything. We tell her before the wedding, what did the rabbi do? He told the witness, is this worth a pruta? The idea is that you're getting married to him with the thought that even if it's worth only 25 agurot, 50 agurot, whatever a pruta is nowadays, you're going to get married to him. That's why the rabbi shows the witnesses and asks loudly, is this worth a pruta? We know it's worth more than a pruta. What we're really saying is the woman can't say later, oh, I didn't mean to get married to him for the ring that's worth this much. I thought it was worth more. And that's the idea behind getting a ring that's simple. So she can't claim, I thought it, with all the engravings, it was worth much more. So that's the basis for the original custom of getting a simple ring. That's also why some have the custom that the kala wears a veil that's very thick, that she can't see the ring clearly. She can't say, I saw it and I thought it was worth such and such. It's a thick veil. You didn't see clearly. You knew you weren't seeing clearly. We gave you a ring. You heard it was worth a pruta. You agreed to get married on the basis that it's worth at least a pruta. It's worth at least a pruta. So you make sure you have a ring. Make sure you have a ksuba. Ksuba you could get for free from the Rabbanut when you sign up, or you could buy ones at the different stores. They're not too expensive. I brought a backup. You should know that there are different versions of the ksuba. Some of them add all kinds of things, which you could consult with your rabbi if you want to bind yourself to them. For example, there are ksubas in Israel that say that the rabbanut will give you, that say that you agree that you will not leave the country unless the badatz permits you. The rabbanut gave me such a ksuba initially when I came to them. So I read through the ksuba and I said, hey, that's not my tradition. I didn't... what I learned is I don't have to sign to that I'm going to go to the badatz before I leave the country. So I went to the rabbi who was preparing the kedushin, and badatz is the court of the high court. I'm going to get authorization before I leave the country. That means before I go to visit my parents, I can get permission. I'm not going to do that. You can't sign something I'm not going to do. So you could say it means for a long period. Okay, what's a long period? Over a month. Okay, what when I visit my parents for over a month, so then I'm not keeping the clauses of the ksuba. So I went to Rabbi Shapiro, who was the one who was organizing the Kedushin, he was the Masadi Kedushin, asked him if it's okay if I switch it, and we did switch it. So the Rabbanut wasn't too pleased with me, but I told him, I don't want this version, that's not my tradition, so we switched it. You get two copies from the Rabbanut, one which stays at the Rabbanut, and one which the rabbi signed. A woman is not supposed to stay with her husband unless she has a ksuba. So the Rabbanut, sometimes people lose their ksubas. It's not right. You're not supposed to lose your ksuba. But this backup copy, the Rabbanut leaves, so that in case you lose your ksuba, you could come back and they have a backup copy. The backup copy is on a plain piece of paper. It's supposed to be word for word what you're signing. So make sure if you're buying a new ksuba that it matches the backup copy that the Rabbanut gives you. When you get to the wedding hall, so you're supposed to have the ksuba with you and the ring. Before the wedding, the Rabbanut makes you bring witnesses that you were never married before, or that you're a bachelor, that you had a proper divorce beforehand. This is any two friends. It's not real testimony. You could bring even relatives to testify that you're a bachelor. And the rabbi who's officiating the wedding, the Mesader Kiddushin, has to sign that he's going to do it, and the Rabbanut has to approve.
Is there, must be religious people?
Yes. I think they expect religious people, but I'm not sure.
Oh, because they're a testimony.
It's not real testimony. You can never testify that something never was. There's no such testimony in halacha. You can't testify this man was never married. You don't know. You could testify, as far as I know, I've always known him as a bachelor. That's
if
all you could testify.
No.
They were assuming you would know, but it's not real testimony. That's why your cousin can go, and your uncle can go. Your parents can't go. For the wedding, you need testimony. You're going to need witnesses that are real witnesses. Some have the custom, this is especially true in chutzlarts, that at the wedding they do the tna'im, that they write this condition. I promise that I will come to the wedding and I'll fund this much, and it's a game. The idea of the Tnaim was in Europe when people would get engaged a year before they got married, and they'd spend a year investing money and inviting guests and preparing for the wedding and buying a house. So then the Tnaim was very serious. They take a piece of earthenware and they break it, and that was a sign, we're agreeing, my son's going to marry your daughter, this is what we'll give them. By the Hasidim, the Tnaim is still very serious. They really write how much money each one's going to give each side. But by us today, it's almost a non-entity, and some rabbis don't like it. That's where Rabbi Feinstein compiled the version that you should sign for the Tnaim, which basically says, if I like it, I'll keep what I said. Basically means nothing. That was the idea. He said, it's not right that you're signing a document that says this is what we owe one another when you're not really getting married. So that's why most people don't do Tnaim today. There are opinions that say you should do Tnaim. Ask your rabbi, ask them Sadaq Yidushin. There are opinions that say that you can make Tnaim at the wedding, which again, that's a game. What are you saying? In 10 minutes, I promise I will marry you. Okay, so go marry her. What are you doing? So what's the big advantage of writing Tnaim? In case you have 500 uncles and you have 300 rabbis coming to the wedding, you have to honor all of them. So you make a Tnaim, you could give them a bunch more honors. You could take two witnesses for the writing of the Tnaim and two witnesses for the signing of the Tnaim and one person to read the Tnaim. So really, the writing of the Tnaim, you don't have two witnesses for, but you could have two witnesses sign the Tnaim and one person give them the honor of reading the Tnaim, and there you've gained another 3 kibbudim, which, surprise, surprise, when it comes to a wedding, is a big deal. A lot of people want honors. And being that the Tnaim aren't such a big deal, so you could ask the rabbi, it might be you could be more lenient and take witnesses who aren't really God-fearing people, because it's not, it doesn't really mean much. Before you do that, ask your rabbi. The rabbi is Mesedar Kiddushin. He's the one that runs the show. So when you reach the wedding, you have the ring with you, you have the ksuba with you, and you've arranged with the rabbi who's Mesedar Kiddushin, who's running the show. Preferably, you should also notify the people you're honoring in advance, especially if there are people who are not well-versed with reading Hebrew, so they could practice the brachot. That helps them. If you're having relatives coming to the wedding and you're going to honor them with brachot, so sometimes it helps that you tell them which blessing they're going to get. I know people who practice for a month beforehand with the tape recorder reviewing the blessing, and that helps them. Why not give them that opportunity? And this way they're not embarrassed. If your grandfather isn't well-versed in reading Hebrew, so why not give them that, or your uncle, or whatever it is? You should speak to the rabbi before the wedding and decide with your kala and her family who you're giving which honors to. Speak to the rabbi about whether you could honor a person who's not a God-fearing person with the blessings. A person who does not keep Shabbos, etc. Can you honor him with a blessing under the chokmah? You have to speak to the rabbi and see what he says, that Ravum Seder Kiddushin will guide you on. If not, then you have to figure out how you get out of it. The ancient custom used to be that one person got all the honors. One person did all the blessings and one person read the ksuba. And that's a good way of getting out of giving honors. The one rabbi, he got all the blessings. He's the one officiating on the wedding. So then there are no fights. And there are people who invite many, many rabbis to a wedding who take that custom, because that way there are no fights. He's the rabbi, he's running the show, and he's getting all the blessings, and no one could be upset. In most instances today, we do divide brachos, and we honor people with the blessings. You should know that there's a hierarchy in the honors of the blessings. Different blessings are worth different amounts. And some people have understanding in this. Like the first two blessings usually go together, and they're worth this much. The last blessing is worth this much. You should know that there are people who care, and you have to know what you're doing. Consult with your rabbi before you do it. When you divide it between you and your kala, so the kala's rav, etc., also need certain honors. So you have to see how you divide it. There are customs when it comes to this. When it comes down to the wire, discuss it with someone and figure out how to do it. When you get to the wedding, so ordinarily the chassan sits at the table and his friends are there and they sing with him in preparation for the wedding. The kala is in her place and people sing with her. Today people shower upon you all kinds of prayers to say, and the kala has all kinds of prayers to say. People usually stop you 10 times between each prayer. The day of the wedding, it is customary that chassan and kala fast, depending if you're Sephardi, Ashkenazi, it depends on which day of the month you're getting married. Could be you won't have to fast. Consult with your rabbi if it's Rosh Chodesh, etc. There are times when you will not have to fast. If you're fasting, so there are those that say that you could stop fasting when it's nightfall, if you're getting married after nightfall. Fasting is not eating tzum. And if you're going to eat or drink before the wedding, then you have to make sure not to eat anything intoxicating. We don't have time, so we'll get to questions next week, I guess. The friends are with the chasen, the friends are with the kala. The day of the chasana, it's customary that chasana goes to a mikveh. Please go to a clean mikveh. Please be very, very careful when you go to the mikveh. Too many accidents happen. Take care. The every chassan has to take care, because chassanim, almost every chassan I know was almost killed during the period that he's a chassan. Chassanim have their heads in the clouds. You have to be extra careful. I tell chassanim, make believe you're 12 years old again, and you look both ways three times before you cross every street. Every chassan I know, I think, with very rare exceptions, almost gets run over during the period of the engagement. What? Be surprised how much chassanim aren't here. I tell chassanim they shouldn't drive, they should have a driver, and kala is the same thing. Take into account that if the kala is taking pills towards the wedding, then it's very common that she's going to have very frayed nerves. One of the things that the hormones do is they make their nerves go wacky, with many other side effects, and that's normal. That's why I recommend, even though halachically you're not obligated to stop talking to the kala a week before the wedding, it's only customary not to see her, I recommend that you tell her that your rabbi said you shouldn't talk, and don't talk that week. It'll do you both a lot of good. Maximum, send one another gifts with letters. In a letter, you could be calm. Talking, I don't recommend it. Save it for the wedding night. That's my recommendation. Other people tell you other things. Do whatever you want. The day of the chasana, some have the custom to read off till, go to all kinds of rabbis, get blessings, go to the kotel and daven, do whatever you want. The only custom that really has strong foundation, as far as I know, is fasting that day. And I strongly recommend you get a good nap in. I didn't do that. And in all my wedding pictures, you'll see me looking like a banshee. there's nothing you can do. If you don't sleep, it's going to show. And it'll also show on how you enjoy the wedding. It's a pity. It's well recommended to sleep. Don't forget that during the dancing, everyone else gets a break. You have to dance with everyone. Hopefully you get to sit. But it's recommended you rest the day of the chasana. You shower, take an extra set of clothing to the wedding, and there's a long list I could give you of things to prepare for the wedding, like mouthwash, but when you're a chassan, call me up, I'll give you the list. That's not what we're doing here. Back to what's really happening at the wedding. So everyone is with you, the rabbi comes in, you have your two witnesses, you write up the rabbi writes up the ksuba, he asks for your name, your parents' name, if there are going to be complications as to what your real name is, what your parents' real name is, so present the rabbi with the complications before the wedding. You're going to have to meet with him before the wedding anyways. It's a good recommendation. Go with the kala. It's a good habit that you and the kala go to a rabbi together. Get your picture with the rabbi, and that'll be the opening page of your album, your wedding album. It's a good habit that you get used to going to the rabbi together, you and your kala. And when you go to the rabbi, so ask him all the questions that you need about how you spell your name and her name. If your father's name is... I don't know, think of some complicated Russian name. So he wants to know before he gets to the wedding that he might have complications and he has to look up how he's going to spell that name at the wedding. So lay the things on the table when you get there, any questions you might have. And you could call the rabbi, hopefully, and ask him the questions you'll have before the wedding. You write up the ksuba. The ksuba, you get a form and you fill in whatever's missing, the date and where the wedding is taking place. And then after that's ready, so Rav Ram Shapiro says you should daven ma'ariv before you proceed with the wedding, because once you begin the wedding, you're a chatan, and you're not really obligated to daven ma'ariv. You're busy with your mitzvah. But not everyone does that. So either you daven ma'ariv or you go to the kala, and then you do what's called the badekin. The badekin is really covering the kala with the veil. Now, it's very interesting that when it comes to the marriage ceremony, we don't really know what's going on halachically. We have a lot of traditions, and we have a lot of gemaras that use a lot of terms. And funny enough, when it comes to the bottom line, how does it all work? There are a lot of opinions. So that seems a little strange, but that's the way it is. So one opinion says that what is the chuppah? So we think chuppah is that canopy. Yeah, that's the generally accepted opinion. But there is an opinion that says that the chuppah is the covering her with the veil. The ancient custom used to be that the chassan didn't even go to cover her with the veil, but rather she was covered and the rabbis would go and bless her. Just like when Rivka left her father to go to marry Yitzchak, so she was blessed, so too the kala would be blessed. And the Yekis still have that custom that the fathers bless the kala. Her father puts his hand on her head, his father puts his hands over her head, he can't touch her, and they give her the blessing, etc. No, sorry. We just don't have time. We're already supposed to finish now, so I'd rather get in another 2 minutes. The kala's head is covered. It is customary that the Jerusalem custom is that the chassan's father and the kala's father walk him. The chassan's father on his right and the kala's father on his left, they walk him to cover the kala. They each one carry a candle in their hand. That's one of the things you should prepare in advance. There are gemachs that give candles. And they walk him down. You need four candles because the two fathers need candles and the two mothers need candles. Out of Yerushalayim, there are different customs. Some have the custom that the father and the mother walk down their child to the badekin and then to the chuppah. In Israel, the custom is that people dance in front of the chassan as he walks down to cover the kala with the veil, which is called the badekin, and then the chassan walks to the chuppah. In the United States, so maybe in Europe too, I don't know, there are customs about how you do all of this with the piano, with the music playing. He walks down the aisle with the flower girls, okay? You guys know all that. That's not halacha, that's custom. So the custom here in Israel is that people dance in front of the chassan when he goes to the chuppah, and then they dance in front of the kala after the chassan reaches the chuppah, so then the kala comes to the chuppah. And she also is led with her. The Jerusalem custom is that the two mothers take her outside Jerusalem, so there are different customs, whether it's the two mothers or her father and mother that lead her down the aisle. If she doesn't have a mother or she doesn't have a father, so then the close relatives, it seems that that's the custom. That's what I've seen. I didn't see it written anywhere, but that's what I've seen. They take her down the aisle. When she comes down the aisle, so the custom is that the chassan step forward to greet her, as the pasuk says, "Vuke chatan yitzem chupato." Sorry, like a chassan walking out of the chuppah, we describe the son like a chassan walking out of the chuppah to greet his kala. So too, the chassan is supposed to walk forward to greet the kala when she comes in. It's just a step or two forward. Some have the custom out of the chuppah. Don't forget that the chuppah is the canopy that's representing his home, and he's taking her into his home when he's where he's going to marry her. That's why some have the custom that before the wedding, some say halachically, the chassan should go to the owner of the hall and tell him, I want to buy the area of the chuppah from you so that I'm taking the kala into my own home. So that, so to speak, is my area. Now, you don't have to pay him $500 for it. You can tell him, for tonight, give it to me for 2 shekel. And you give him 2 shekel, and then he gives you that. There's also a custom that the cheder yichud, the room where they are going to be alone, should also be owned by the chassan. The same concept, that he's taking her, so to speak, into his home. So the chassan and kala come under the chuppah. The kala is led around the chassan. She's led by her mother, and her mother-in-law walks behind her. And they go around the chassan 7 times. There are different minhagim as to what song is being sung while they go around the chassan 7 times. And then the kala stands to his right. The chassan is on the left. The kala to his right. Her mother on the right. His father, the father's on the left. The mother's on the right. And the rabbi officiating the Masadir Kedushin calls the two Edom forward. We have a cup of blessing. He blesses Bori Priagafen. And then he makes the blessing of the first stage of marriage, which we could call engagement. It's the stage called Kiddushin. And that blessing is really being made for the chassan, but because not all chassanim knew that blessing by heart, so the custom became that the rabbi makes it for all the chassanim, so that the chassan who doesn't know it by heart won't be embarrassed. The Yemenites, for example, have the custom that the chassan is read the blessing word by word by the rabbi, but really the chassan makes the blessing. But when the rabbi is making the blessing, you have to listen because he's making that blessing for you. When he makes the blessing on the wine, he's making that blessing for you. You're going to drink from that wine, as will your kala. And when he's making the blessing on the marriage ceremony, so that blessing is really your blessing. It's your blessing on the mitzvah of marrying this girl. So you have to listen and say amen in the end, and have in mind that that blessing is for you. After he makes both those blessings, you drink from the wine, and your kala drinks from the wine. The first cup of wine, this cup of wine, she's going to be given by her mother to drink. And she lifts the veil, gives her to drink, and then the witnesses are called forward, and the chassan is asked to give the ring. The rabbi asks the witnesses if this ring is worth a pruta. The witnesses that you choose may not be relatives, and we go very distant, even second cousins, we go very distant to what we call relatives, and they have to be kosher Jews. They have to be Jews that are fitting to be witnesses. Someone who doesn't keep Shabbos may not be your witness. It has to be someone who's fit to be a witness, someone who's a God-fearing person. The custom is that we tell the witnesses before they are going to be witnesses for the wedding, the rabbi whispers to them, do tshuva. Because the period of testifying over a wedding ceremony is considered a special thing, and the witnesses should do tshuva before they do it. It's scary. I've been witness quite a few times, and it's scary when the rabbi suddenly tells you, do tshuva. Okay. The chassan then tells her, and the rabbi should hopefully have it on a card, but just in case, you should prepare a card. Harei at mekudeshet li, behold, you will become set aside in holiness to me. Betabat zu, with this ring, kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, as is the custom of Moshe that was instituted for the Jewish people, and is the custom of the Jewish people. And then he places it on this finger, not the ring finger. She extends this finger, and you put it on her finger. There are, after this, really, we're going to have another cup of wine. We're going to do the second stage of marriage. But You just made a blessing on one cup of wine. How can you make a blessing on another cup of wine? So therefore, we do a pause. What's the pause that we do? The custom is that we call the next in line, the next highest rabbi. The highest rabbi is given the honor of being Mesadak Kedushin running the show. The next in line is given the honor of reading the Ksuba. And he reads the Ksuba. Ashkenazim have the custom that he reads the whole Ksuba. As far as them say, it's no one's business to hear how much money you're promising the girl in the Ksuba. So after he reads a certain section, the rabbi says, enough, everyone knows what's coming up, so we could skip the rest. That's to be more modest, as far as Memphis custom, that we don't read the whole Ksuba out loud. No one has to know how much money you promised your wife. That's enough of a pause. Then we go to the second stage of marriage. Now, some have a custom at this point to break the glass. Initially, the custom was that the glass that you made the blessing of Bore Pri Agafen on was the glass that was broken. Today, no one has that custom anymore. They have a separate cup that they set aside that you break, prepare it wrapped up so that someone should prepare it so that you don't have broken glass all over. But the initial custom used to be that the glass of Kiddushin, the first glass you cup, would be the glass that you broke. Today, that's not the custom. Next, we go to the second stage of marriage, and God willing, this is where we'll pick up next week. We're already 10 minutes over time.